Okay, it's 2 o'clock. Let's get started. Welcome to the Continuing Physics Seminar Series. Today's speaker is Dr. Ken Pin Hoang from GE Healthcare. He works in the physics group at GE in MR and MRI applications. He got an undergraduate degree from the University of California, Berkeley, then went on to an aspiring biomedical engineering degree at Case Western. Mm-hmm. And then right after that, he was hired 9 years ago by GE Healthcare and has been working in this exciting field. So let's all welcome Dr. Hoang.
Thank you. So to be more specific, I'm actually based in Houston at MD Anderson Cancer Center, even though GE Healthcare is based in Milwaukee. We have a lot of collaborations with MD Anderson, but over there I'm able to do work with them in areas such as radiation therapy. So, first of all, disclaimer, I'm not selling anything. The FDA decides what drugs can be marketed. They also decide what devices can be marketed. So there are stuff here that are not available commercially yet. And another disclaimer is that even though my title is a scientist and a physicist, I was not trained as a physicist. So MRI, I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with this. This is probably what you think of, with MRI. It's like a big long tunnel. You go in, makes some noise, and some images come out. It continues to evolve. And more recently, we've come out with like small MRI. It's basically just big enough for you to put your arm or like through. It's good for applications such as sports injuries and such like that. Now, for all these purposes, it's primarily a diagnostic tool and has been for the past 25 years. Okay? Meaning is that it's used to go in and see what's wrong inside your body. But increasingly, it's being used to guide and plan therapies. Okay? So this is this picture up here is a mock-up by Brain Lab. They're a company that helps set up these neurosurgical suites with an intraoperative MRI. So that's the MRI in the back right over here. So the idea is that the surgeon can operate on the patient here. And as needed, they can put it in the MRI to update the progress in the surgery. For example, if he wants to know how close am I to that nerve bundle, or how close am I to that blood vessel, how much more tissue do I need to take out? That can be done with the intraoperative MRI. Much more precise than getting image, okay, go in and take that out. Right? You can do it, not real time, but at least intraoperatively while you're doing the procedure. But what I'm more focused on is radiation therapy planning. This is the use of highly focused radiation beams targeted towards cancer. It requires immobilization of the patient. As you can see here, you have these masks that kind of form to the patient. And so how do we use MRI for that? So this is a quick overview of my talk, I guess. Let's start with the image contrast in MR versus CT. How do you form images in MR? And distortion in MR, what causes it? And also, finally, look at how we can, simulate the CT using MR images. Okay, so magnetic resonance. It's measuring the resonant response of subatomic magnetic particles to an external stimulus. Okay? It's the basis of NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance, which is used a lot for analysis in chemistry, and the same thing as magnetic resonance imaging. Right? And MRI originally was called NMR imaging, but as it was released clinically, they decided that people didn't like to hear the word nuclear, so they kind of dropped that. So the way it works is that all particles have this quantum mechanical property called spin. And spin couples to the magnetic world via magnetism. Okay, so for our purposes, for an engineer such as me, we kind of model this as just kind of like a tiny bar magnet. Kind of a nucleon-sized bar magnet. So both electrons and nucleons have spin. Progress in the area of EPR, but again, we're dealing with NMR, which is a nuclear magnetic resonance. And this could only be measured from nuclei with non-zero net spin. Now, we don't have to look very far to find a good candidate because hydrogen itself does exhibit an NMR signal. And hydrogen is very abundant in the body, in water as well as fat, which is these long hydrocarbon chains. All right, so what happens to these tiny magnets when you put them in a magnetic field? Well, they start to align with it. Right? And this would be the case, you know, at equilibrium, if we were at absolute zero. Okay? But because we're not, we have to deal with thermal energy. So it affects our SNR. How much so? Well, if we look at the applied magnetic field, creates two distinct quantum spin energy states. Okay? So there's a spin up and spin down, basically align with the field or align against the field. And there's an energy difference between the two states, which is delta E, is a magnetic nuclear magnetic moment times the field. Right? And the ratio between them is described in this equation here. Number of spins aligned with, or spins against, is E to the negative delta E over KT, where K is the Boltzmann constant, T is the temperature. Well, it turns out it's about 7 parts per million. Okay, for room temperature at 1 Tesla, and again, looking at hydrogen. All right, so thermal energy by far drowns out the inherent SNR. Okay, so what do we do? Well, luckily we're imaging hydrogen. Again, very abundant in the body. Okay, so we can look at these spins in aggregate. So when we look at an image, you know, divided up into these square pixels or boxes, you know, we can think of each one as an ensemble of spins. We also note that the polarization goes up with the applied field strength. Okay? We do not want to run this at very low field strength because we simply do not get that signal. So an MR magnetism we actually measure is the total magnetization of the ensemble. Again, that little pixel or that little voxel size. And that's really the sum of all these small nuclear magnets in the paragraph state. So why are these called spins and not just, you know, simple dipoles? Right? And it's because these exhibit angular momentum, right? Just like you know, if I take this and just leave it on the table, you know, it just falls down like that, right? But if I were to take a top, you know, or a gyroscope, spin it, has an angular momentum, it resists that, right? Not only that, it precesses, right? So it spins about its axis, but its axis also spins around its own axis. And so the same thing with our spins, right? Because of their angular momentum, they don't relax back to the equilibrium state right away, or at least relative to the time constants of our measurements. They precess. And they start relaxing back, you know, until they align with the field. But they are precessing while they do that. And the frequency of that is simply given by this equation here, what we call the Larmor equation. Or the Larmor precession frequency of Eganaut is equal to some constant gamma times the magnetic field. Pretty simple equation. So all we have to know, really, is what is the local field of those spins. Right? Then we can determine what frequency they're going to be spinning at. Now we're going to be coming back to that one. Now, commonly, you know, because these are, you know, these spins are rotating, it's easier to look at this in a rotating frame. So the laboratory frame and observers here, while everything's spinning, but if we are making our observations in the rotating frame, you kind of take out that omega naught, then it makes it easier to analyze small differences from that center frequency, that center omega naught. Because some spins are going to be precessing faster or slower than the center frequency. Okay? So, how do we take spins from the ground state and put them into the superposition of the precession state? Okay? So we increase the probability of the spin looking to the excited state using input radio frequency energy. Why radio frequency? Well, it turns out that for hydrogen at 1.5 T, the Larmor frequency is about 63 megahertz. So we start with quantum spin space probability in terms of observable ensemble average N. Okay, so here we have a lot of them canceling out, but there is some of them that in aggregate gives you this net magnetization line of the field. So we apply the orthogonal magnetic field that is oscillating at that frequency, at this long alarm frequency. That increases the probability of spin flips. Okay? So if you apply some energy, then you can get to a point where the number of spins aligned with the field are equal to that opposed to the field. That's what we call a 90-degree flip angle. If you apply a little bit more, you can actually get more of them aligned against the field. Now, how do we analyze this in the MR field? So the on-resonant IRS process is going to be explained really using a classical law. Okay, so in the rotating frame, we have our B1 field, which is this orthogonal field. Now, again, this B1 is a radio frequency wave kind of oscillating, but it's within the rotating frame, it's constant. And when it's applied there, it tips the magnetization away from the equilibrium. So depending on the amplitude and the duration of its pulse, we get a flip angle up. So even though things happen on a quantum level, we can predict most of these things using classical physics. All right, so we can do this. You know, we can pick up an MR signal with a bunch of water molecules. Okay, so what does that do for us? Okay, well, for one, it gives us density of hydrogen. Is that very interesting? So it's okay, but the real clinical power of MR is the ability to differentiate water molecules in different environments. Okay? So for example, we're able to distinguish gray matter, white matter, fluid, bone marrow, muscle, a whole bunch of things. Okay? And a lot of it is based on the relaxation, okay? Which is, you can think of it as how fast it relaxes back to the equilibrium. Okay? So here's one type of contrast that you can get. It's called T1 weighted contrast. This is a contrast where we weight it based on how fast they're relaxing to equilibrium. Right? There's this type of energy. There's also T2 contrast, which is after you excite the spins. Basically, how long does that signal stay for? Because that signal, it's like imagine if you play a note on a piano or something, or a strum. After a while, it decays away. And that decay rate is different for different tissues. You can get generated contrast based on that. And this is what proton density might look like. So this is not, we're not incorporating any relaxation at all. And these contrasts can be acquired with the same MRI machine just by tweaking these parameters here. Okay, so clinical utility of MR really comes from several things. So hydrogen is the source of our signal. There's hydrogen, again, is very abundant in the body. There's no ionizing radiation. We're dealing with radio frequency waves. And this is something that you don't necessarily need to tell your mom or lay people about this, because they're concerned enough about like cell phone radiation, such as it is. But really, the main power from MR is the functional imaging and all the different kinds of images that you can get from it. Right? So sure, there's proton density and contrast based on relaxation times. We can identify different chemical species, such as difference between fat and water. Sometimes some metabolites as well, just like citrate, choline. There's ability to assess motion with it, just flow, diffusion. And also because blood itself has iron in it, and that affects the local magnetic properties, you can generate contrast based on the flow of blood as well. So with all these wonderful things you can do with MR, what do physicians use primarily for planning radiation therapy? Well, it's not MR. It's CT. So I'm going to jump into CT a little bit. And how does CT work? And I think CT I can explain in just basically like two slides. most people find CT much more straightforward than MR. But you start with the X-ray radiography. Right? You shine X-rays through your hand. Tech comes out the other side, then you get an image. Right? Pretty simple, pretty straightforward. Okay? So the raw data you collect is an image space. Right? So CT is taking those X-rays and shooting them in from various angles. Right? So CT is known as X-ray convenience tomography. It's also known as CT or CAT scan. So if you look at this example here, we actually have a disc over here. and we shine beams through in this direction, and we collect from what's on the other side, and get a projection image here. So it's like, yeah, okay, we detect that there's something along this ray right here, so you can trace it. If we do one in the perpendicular direction, right, you can again find where that is, and you can trace the ray like that. Now, if you knew that your object was a disk, then we could say, oh, I know what that is. But if we don't know what that shape is, we're going to need more views. Okay, so here's another view coming in from another angle, and we can trace that ray anyway. So if you get enough of these views, all right, at fine enough angles, and you put a lot of them together, you get an image that looks like that. And somewhat blurred, but you can apply a filter to it and then do some processing, and that's you can get your CT image. So, now, the problem with CT, contrast-wise, for medical purposes, is that its contrast is dependent primarily on density. Okay? You look at the CT image, bone's a lot more dense than tissue, so it shows up very, very well. However, the difference between the soft tissues is minimal. I mean, since the grayscale and the coloring of each tissue, of each organ, looks very much like the one next to it. So you can look at it morphologically, you can find the shapes of things. But where they're touching, it's kind of hard to tell where the border of one is versus the other. Okay? And so here at the bottom is an example of a study. This is actually done a while ago. But they had various physicians try to contour the prostate on the CT. Okay? And just look at the variability. So as you go through and see, they go like this, and maybe it's not so bad here, but you see that they tend to do this slice by slice. And the problem with doing this method is like you're going through, and it's hard to tell where you stop as you're going through the slices. Right? So some physicians might stop, at one point, some's over here, some might stop up over here. So hence this big jump. And so the difference in volume, these are different physicians along here. It's going to vary from physician to physician. But sometimes physicians, they also had them come back, like 2 weeks later and contour again. And there's differences even between themselves, okay? So this is like a 25% difference, in volume between one physician, right? And even greater in this case. So it would be nice to be able to use MR for contour. But why do they use CT? Well, it's analogous to external beam radiation therapy. Right? And CT, we're shooting X-rays, about 25 to 150 kV or so, and shooting very broadly, and collecting on the other side to get an image. Well, for radiation therapy, we're applying a very tightly focused beam. Typically, the energy is 300 kV to 25 mV or so. And it's so precise. Okay? We're talking about a millimeter accuracy from away. Right? Now, that millimeter accuracy is worthless if you cannot control where your patient is to that degree. So that means you have to be able to align your patient down to that millimeter accuracy. Right? So we have devices like this. Okay? We have masks that are custom formed for each patient. Okay? So that they're held in a very specific position. And this patient is also biting on a bite bar, okay? So it has grooves in it to put their teeth in, so that the jaw is, and hence the neck close to that area, is also in the same position. Right? So radiation, as it goes in, you also need to be able to determine what dose is actually getting to the tumor. Right? So the benefit of CT is that you have that density information from CT, and you do an attenuation correction on the dose to map where this radiation dosage is going. Okay, so how much is in the tumor, and how much of it is actually going out to healthy tissue. All right, so how is CT used? Well, this is kind of the workflow that's shown here. You image the patient in what we call a treatment position. Okay, so whatever position you image the patient in, you're going to try to replicate that same position during treatment. So you bring a patient in, you create these masks, these molds, use these immobilization devices, put them in a very strictly defined position, and image them. So with those images, you go through it's called simulation. You simulate what the therapy would be like. All right? So you go through, you draw the organs, you draw the target that you want to get. You place your beams on it. And then you go through treatment planning, which is the calculation of the dosage, you know, using the electron densities from your CT image. And treatment delivery is not all applied at once. This is actually applied one day at a time over the course of 6 to 8 weeks. Okay? So every day that the patient comes in, they have to use those masks, stay in that same position, or at least try to get as close to that same position as possible, and run that same So what are the advantages of CT? Well, typically it's easier to make wide bores with CT. Though recently MRs have started getting wider in bore size as well. And we've also developed immobilization devices that are compatible for use in MR. So that's probably not so much a problem. But there still remains a problem with density information. Okay? MR provides proton density. I realize you physicists probably hate that. It's not really proton. It's really hydrogen density. Medical community, it's always called proton density. And also spatial accuracy of MR. Okay? So MR has been known to have some distortions. Okay? And one thing I haven't told you yet is how does MRI create images? Well, it's the use of gradients or encoding them with frequency. Okay? So coming back to the Langevin equation, right? Our frequency is proportional to the magnetic field. So if our field is constant, you know, that's not very interesting. But the kind of aha moment, you know, that Lauterbur had in the 70s, he's considered kind of like the father of MRI, right, is that you apply a gradient, right, to the field. Okay? So your field is varying in a linear manner. Then you have this encoding between the frequency and the position that these spins are at. Right? So your B is now dependent on X, is there's a main magnetic field, B0, plus a gradient times x versus position. Right? Together, you know, the frequency spins that is just proportional to that. Or if we just take out, if we use a rotating reference frame, then we just take out B0 and we just look at the gradient. So what does our signal, our RF signal look like? Well, it looks something like this. It's a summation of the spin densities. Okay, so this is, you can think of this as the image that you want to get. Okay, we have spins at a position x that we want to be able to capture, and the times e to the I omega t. So this is just your cosine times I sine function, right? And the summation of these gives you your signal. Right? And we can get back the density function just by applying an inverse Fourier transform. Right? It's basically just want to detect where these frequencies are at. So, right? And so here's like a simplistic view of what the Fourier transform does. Okay? So if you had a piano, right, that had, you know, they had all the keys there, it looks like a regular piano. Okay? And let's say you can't look inside. Right? What would be the quickest way to find, you know, the strings that are there? Okay? And let's say you're missing most of the few strings. What's the quickest way to find the strings that are there? Well, one way to do it is that you go through and you play one key at a time. Right? So he's going through one thing. There's nothing. Oh, there's something there. Right? And then you go through. There's nothing there. Oh, and he finds another key that's playing. Okay? And maybe he hits another key. Oh, okay. So there's another peak there. And go through and kind of just determine which keys have their strings, which keys don't. Okay? And this is a map now. Okay. So. For whatever frequency or whatever key you're playing, you can get an amplitude and say, you know, how loud that string is resonating. Right? For another way is that you just hit them all at once. Okay, now I wouldn't use a bomb, right? But I think they're just going for dramatic effect here. If you just play them all at once, okay, you get all these frequencies superimposed. Right? But we collect that signal and we're able to reconstruct those same frequencies using the Fourier transform. So that's kind of what we do in MR. Okay. So that's in one dimension. 2D encoding, it's more complicated. I'll just say that you know, we have gradients in the orthogonal direction, and with the right sequences of them, you can apply and you get 2D frequency space, from which you apply a 2D Fourier transform onto. Okay? So this is what our 2D frequency space looks like, or what we call K-space. Right? So for each one of these lines, okay, say you know, we have gradients applied in this direction, we also have the other orthogonal gradient here. And if you apply a 2D Fourier transform on it, then, then we get our this. Now, again, all this you know, is dependent on the use of gradients. Okay, so why do we have distortion? All right. Well, it goes back to this equation again. So you know, omega is gamma b naught plus our gradient. But however, in reality, you know, our main magnetic field is not perfectly uniform. So that's actually some function. Our gradient field is not perfectly linear. Okay? So again, we have to describe this as a function of x, as opposed to just some constant or some slope times x. There's also a phenomenon called chemical shift, okay? And that actually the spins of a fat are resonating at a slightly different frequency than that of water. Okay? And there's really not much we can do about that. But if you put that all together, and again, moving back to the rotating reference frame, our frequency looks like this. We have a chemical shift that's dependent on the field. Our main field is 1.5 tesla, for example. And also plus variations in the main magnetic field, plus some gradient function. So here I got through and kind of did a simulation and calculated based on our spec sheets. Spec sheets for homogeneity of the magnet, and also other things such as drift of the magnet and current currents, and residual gradient area involved. And you can see that while there are other sources of distortion, these are really the dominant ones. Homogeneity, we're talking about millimeters here, and sometimes centimeters at the very edge of the field here. All right, and once again, going back to the precision that we want to reach, radiation therapy. Right? If somebody wants to use MR for planning these radiation therapies, this could be very strict. Right? So we want to see what we can do about this. Okay. So what does this gradient look like? Okay. What exactly is it doing? Okay? So this gradient coil looks like this. We're constrained by the cylindrical shape of the MRI, right? And it creates these windings in a pattern like this. And what we can do is we can model the gradient coils. And the way we model the gradient coils is kind of like going back to the way we designed it. And the way you would design it is you break it into smaller building blocks. Okay? So there are known configurations, such as a Maxwell coil, Mohs coil, Saddle coil. And you take these building blocks and you can put them together. Right? And the magnetic induction caused by these can be described with spherical harmonic basis functions. Right? So when you superimpose them, it's just a matter of adding up these basis functions. And then you have your representation of your overall magnetic field in these spherical harmonic basis functions. Okay, so what does this look like? What exactly does gradient look like? So this is probably the best case scenario. So this is, we're looking at one line right through the middle of the magnet, left to right. Okay, so let's say the bore of the magnet is running this way. The cylinder is running this way. We're plotting the field along this line. Okay. But the units I'm using, well, you probably can't see the units, but the units I'm using are centimeters. In a sense, you know, what the math x would be in that field versus the physical x. Right? And ideally, this would line perfectly. And that's okay here in the center of the magnet. But you can see as you move out, it starts deviating. These are also maps of the field, but looking at 2D images now. All right? So we had that line through the center. Okay? But now this is an axial view. This is a cut through the body, okay, and through the bore like this. All right? So that plot you saw before would be a line running right through here. Okay? But now we're also looking at the lines plotted across, you know, as you move, say, further out in this direction or further back. Right? And C is, you know, again, it's good in the center, but it gets worse and worse as you move out. Okay? And here's a coronal view. Right? If you take a slice through the body this way, again, the center line, this center line would be the same plot we saw in the previous slide. But here you can see that the gradient, you know, deteriorates much more rapidly. Ideally, these would be all straight lines, okay? It would be, ideally, it would be like x-rays, right? You just have these straight beams going right through. But we don't. We, in a sense, we have kind of curved beams or curved maps to work with. Gradient along z in the superior inferior direction. Now we're drawing a line through center. See this situation is worse. Right? Again, it's okay in the center, but it drops off at the edges. Axial view, we don't really have anything interesting to show because it's perfectly symmetric with respect to Z, so it's just zero. But in this coronal view, see, okay, that line down the middle. Right, it's worse here. And actually, it seems to get better at the edges. So, put that together, what do you get? Well, so here's the uncorrected image. Okay, and if you can guess, this is using a matrix phantom, which I'll explain in a bit. You take this matrix, and it's just like you would do something like this for a camera, right? You take a picture of a grid and look at what distortion you get. Now, since we can model these gradient fields, we can also model the distortion that we're getting. And using spherical harmonics, we can, if we go up to the fifth degree, we get something like this. Right? Now these gradients, because you know they're linear, they're odd functions, so we really only use the odd degree spherical harmonics. Right? So really, one we already know is just that linear term, okay, 1 to 1. And so we're just incorporating 2 more degrees, the third degree and fifth degree, we can get pretty good correction. Now, I show fifth degree because this was actually what was developed like in the beginning of clinical MR, like in the late 80s. Okay, so the code that we have for correcting this is really code from like 1990 or so. And you know, so they applied this, and they thought it was good enough, and they kind of just left it there. And nobody's really touched it for about 20 years. Why did they stop at fifth degree? All right, because we have the higher degrees. Characterizations of these gradients. Well, back then, it was very computationally intensive. Right? You have to calculate these coefficients for each and every pixel in the image. And you know, depending on how many images you get, it could take quite some time. And also, as you go up in degree, as you guys probably know, the computation and time goes up exponentially. So that this was like a good compromise at the time, and they kind of stumbled. So, this phantom, where did it come from? Well, we kind of had to construct our own phantom. You know, we wanted to do this because we wanted to be able to characterize distortion. Right? We do a variable density arrangement where, because we know there's not much distortion in the center, we don't need that many samples in the center. However, we do want more markers out at the edge where things are changing much more rapidly. So we basically put oil capsules in a tooling foam type of material. So this material used for modeling airplanes sometimes. It's pretty lightweight and pretty low cost. Now, when we put this phantom together, all right, we can't be precise down to the millimeter, right? So we, in a sense, calibrated it. Right? And it's probably not obvious to you, but this image here is that of a PET CT. Okay, we're imaging with a CT scan. Okay, and we're using CT data as our reference data. Okay, so whenever we acquire an image for MR, we compare it to what we got in the CT using CT as our gold standard. So even though there are errors in the way we constructed it, it's really the CT that we're comparing it against, and not where we think they are. Okay, so these are kind of template images for where they should be. And these are coronal images, and I take that slice by slice from the bottom up. And you can see, again, in the middle, you know, there's kind of like this this sparser density. Let's just use this. So as you go from slice to slice, you know, you get this alternating pattern. Right? But all around the outside, you have the denser space. And you go up to the top, you know, it narrows down, so that's only like 5 markers across here. And we're kind of cutting it off a little bit at the corners. It turns out that with MR, we can't really image them anyways. And if they are there, sometimes they introduce some artifacts. Okay. So we acquire it with what we call a 3D protocol. We'll talk a little bit about 2D encoding, but there's also possible ways to do it with 3D encoding. We're covering a pretty large field of view with these images. Okay, so okay, another thing I should point out is that we're running at 3 different bandwidths. Okay, and when we talk about bandwidths here, 250 kilohertz, 125, and 62.5 kilohertz, we're talking about how strong we're applying our gradient. Okay? We're applying a gradient so that there's like this 250 kilohertz bandwidth across it, you know, 125 or 62.5. And the idea is that, you know, with a stronger gradient, these small changes in frequency are going to affect it a lot less. So using the highest gradient, I mean, this is the highest possible gradient bandwidth on our scanners. You see, it's not too bad, right? It pretty much resembles our phantom. Maybe if you move out to the edges or move up to the top row again, you see some of this waviness pattern here, okay? And move down. Under 25 kilohertz, okay, this waviness starts getting worse. Okay, you start seeing it more, you know, along these edges here. And again, this top row, you know, it's worse. You see it more on this one as well. But you know, once again, it's in the center. You know, it still looks pretty good. You know, it looks like there's really not much distortion. Now, 62.5 is probably more similar to what we would use in typical clinical imaging, right? And here, you get the distortion that, you know, a lot of physicians associate with MRI, right? A lot of waviness out here. But again, if you're staying within the center volume, you're okay. We were acquiring this with, you know, 64 centimeter field of view, and nobody really does that. Now, typically, if you're doing the brain, it's maybe like 25 centimeters tops. Okay? If you're going through the abdomen, it's maybe about 40 centimeters. So you can cut that down accordingly. Right? So even though we don't reach this area here, sometimes you want to be able to place a device there. Okay? If you're guiding a needle or something like that from the edge of the skin, you could be right in that region. And so we come up with a program, it kind of goes through, matches them to what we expect the locations to be. And we can get a plot of these errors. So each one of these is a plot of its error as a function of its distance from isocenter, the center, the very center magnet, the center of the magnet. Okay. And as we expect, you know, the errors increase as you move out. Right? Now the good news is that we are within a millimeter, okay, up to, you know, about 125 millimeters or so. All right? And that's, again, it's kind of like that 25 centimeter head size volume. Right? Now, keep in mind that we're acquiring this with voxel sizes of 1.25 millimeters squared. Okay, so we're dealing with box size that this, say, like this big. Right, but these measurements we're getting are smaller than that, and the reason we can get that is that we're kind of doing a center of mass calculation on these capsules, so the numbers come out smaller than. Now, there's going to be some uncertainty related to that, though I don't really know exactly what the best way is to calculate that. But we think it's still pretty valid so that it's within that voxel size. And that's what's most important for people to know. For 2 millimeter accuracy, you can go out a little bit more. I'm going to use the same data, but zoom in on part of the plot here. This is from about 40 to 210 or so. You can see it goes up. Now, these are possible outliers. Things may have shifted a little bit between the CT acquisition and the MR acquisition. Again, go up to 2 millimeters. If we look at the 62 kilohertz bandwidth, all right, now the scale on this is different. Okay, so this goes up to 28 compared to the 125, and this only goes up to 14. Okay, but most of the differences are out here. If I zoom into the same section, 62.5 kilohertz plot, it looks virtually identical to 125. So here's 62.5, here's 125. So they're both very similar. So it just goes to show that, you know, because we're staying within this, that central region, it's still pretty good. You get within 2 millimeters in that area. If you're targeting the prostate, then it's really not a problem. So another thing we can do with this is to improve our distortion correction. Right? Like I mentioned before, you know, we were going up to 5th degree. So now we're starting to investigate 9th degree diameter. It's very straightforward to implement. We just kind of go higher in these degrees. And with today's computation, it's really, really a problem. So really, we're going to start really assuming we're going to have 9th degree grad work moving forward. And in our upcoming products, we're going to start implementing this as well. So in a similar fashion, you know, instead of modeling the gradients, we can also incorporate the magnet. So because the main field itself is not uniform, it actually has a pattern that looks like this, okay? And it has this pattern because of the various coils that are in there running in different directions. So that center part, you know, for the region that it was designed for, it looks pretty good. But you can see things deteriorate very, very rapidly once you hit it, all right? So without magnet correction, it'll look like this. And this actually has a 9th degree gradient correction. Okay. But we use this magnetic field map to correct for it. And yeah, these line up a lot better. All right. Now there are certain areas that it doesn't quite fix. Right? Like this edge over here, this edge over here. Right? And that's because the field actually is a little bit different as you go from, you know, one scanner to the other. Sure, there are design specs that we, but they really only address the region in here. So sometimes, you know, they say that, you know, could have an MRI, and you can, somebody brings in like a large metal desk or a large metal file cabinet and install it in the room right above it. That could sometimes affect the field. So each one is actually a unique situation. So that's what we're kind of looking at right now, is how do we measure that field on a scanner to scanner basis. And instead of using just the design specs, okay, use that scanner's own field map signature to do corrections. So, all right. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit. All right. So that's the spatial accuracy aspects of it, and how well we're helping out the field of radiation therapy in that regard. But coming back again to that electron density, right? Is there a way to do planning on MR only instead of CT, right? And, you know, in a way, we're being selfish, right? It's like, you know, why would you really care, right? And again, we say that it's better for contouring, but again, MRs are more expensive than CTs, and they're more complex devices, and the costs are more. But if you can do it all on an MR, it comes with all this, a lot more information. So there's a lot of interest to see if this is really possible. So if we really want to move it to MR only and skip the CT altogether, we want to be able to get some sort of density information from the MR. Now, the way we would approach it is in a sense, we're kind of cheating. Okay? We're just trying to find where the bones are. And so again, if you look at the CT image, you can kind of divide it into three tissue types. You have the bone, you have the soft tissue, and you have the fat. Okay, and you have, you know, air around it. So, right now, we're treating the fat and the other soft tissue, the water-based soft tissue, as one entity for now. But we have sequences that distinguish between water and fat to do that further on. So then it becomes what's called a segmentation problem. Are we able to go through and identify what's bone, what's soft tissue, and what's air? Right? So here's an overview of the segmentation. So we start with MR acquisition, and then we have a what's called a skin segmentation. How do we can we get the outer body contour on MR? Right? Because one other thing with MR is that there's a lot of shading in MR. The intensities On one side of the image could be different on the other, so straight thresholding sometimes does not work. Then we also run a bone segmentation. We go through trying to detect the bones. But if you have that outer contour and you have the bones, then you go through and just start classifying. This is bone, this is air, this is soft tissue. And then you can come up with a pseudo CT, something that looks kind of like a CT. And maybe for a lot of purposes is good enough for radiation therapy. We mentioned before, at the energies that we're dealing with, bound effect is not that dependent on density. So even if this map was not perfect, we might be off only by a few percent. So how do we do that? Well, we create an atlas of the bones in the region. Okay, so this is going to be a region-specific application. We create an atlas of the pelvic bones, we create an atlas of the skull. And this is done by gathering all these CT image data sets and register them, or we kind of align them as best as we can. But once they're aligned, there's like these small variations in each one, so then we can kind of create like this probabilistic map of it. So this is not like a very high resolution image of the bones, but it's just probabilistic. And the way we use it is like this. So we have the input MRI image here, and we start off with that body segmentation. We just find that outer contour. And then we do what we call our bone structure enhancement. It's really kind of like an edge detection step. We kind of go through this image and try to find out where the edges are. And we register the atlas to that. Register, again, it's just lining up the atlas. What's the best way can we line up that atlas to this enhanced image? Okay? So once we have that overlay, let's see, then we kind of use that atlas to filter out which of these edges are we going to keep and which of these are we going to keep. The ones we keep are the ones that are within that atlas or within a certain probability as it turns out the atlas. And that's basically our bone, our bone volumes. Okay? And we do a projection through that, and use that for positioning purposes. And also we have our pseudo CT, which you can use for attenuation correction purposes. Okay, so again, MR images, you get these cortical bone volumes. And once you have the bone volumes, you can do several things with it. You can use it to just overlay and to get enhanced MR images. Do projection on it to get what's called a DRR. Again, it's used mainly for positioning purposes. You know, if you can put essentially an X-ray on your LINAC, on your this linear accelerator that's used for radiation therapy, and make sure that it lines up with that X-ray projection. You can use it as a basis for organ segmentation. This is what we're thinking about. It's like once we have the bones, they're pretty rigid, reliable landmarks. From there, we can kind of guess initially where our organs lie, and we can then automatically kind of determine where to start segmenting these organs as well. And of course, the pseudo CT is mentioned before. Some other views of these bone volumes or these projections. We will continue to work on it. We initially started with something that looks like that, but continue to refine the resolution. We're also developing applications for organ segmentation. Right? And each organ has its own unique characteristics, so there's a unique approach to each one of them. Right now, we're kind of doing what's called a seated approach. Okay? We count on the user to say, okay, the center of this organ is approximately here. And from that, it makes it a lot easier for our algorithms to kind of detect where the edges are. Okay? So, for example, the prostate, you can model what the typical shape of the prostate is like. Right? And you form that shape to the edges of the organ. That would be your that would be your segmented prostate volume. Similarly, for femoral heads, actually. Right? So, well, for the bladder, we take a slightly different approach. Right? So, bladder, we notice that it tends to be bright on T2-weighted images compared to tissue around it. So sometimes intensity thresholds or intensity-based gradients are good enough. With the rectum, it was a lot more challenging. Maybe one C point was not enough. We found a way to do it with two C points, but you might even consider having physician indicate a string of C points. Okay? One thing with the rectum is like we really don't know where to stop or where to start. It really depends on the physician's preference there. So they may have to do that C themselves. So right now we started to integrate that into what our product, which is called Advantage. This is our software that's used for simulating radiation therapy. You see these CT-like images and CT-like projections, but these are all based off of images. So going back to that workflow, the MR-only workflow would pretty much look the same as CT, but we're replacing it with MR. Right? Now, again, the value of this is not just that we replace the CT now. Okay? It's not that we've just made the whole process more expensive, but with the functional imaging of MR, the ability to get the different contrasts, the ability to determine what's happening in your tissues when you're applying the radiation. Okay? So you can acquire some images before treatment, acquire other images during or even after treatment, and you can see the progression of during the treatment. To be able to put that all together to tailor your therapy. So that's all I have for today. And obviously, there's a lot of work I've shown here. I'm from the MR Applied Science Lab, and some of you apparently know Scott Hinks, who's in the past. I'm working in MR engineering and MR oncology. PET as well. Some of this is being used in the area of MR PET. Can we combine a PET machine inside an MR scanner? It's very interesting. It's also very expensive. But some of this work is going to be applied there because PETs, in the same way, uses attenuation correction of the bones. And also, Advantage Workstation Development is the team that does all this implementation. And we have some external collaborators from various hospitals that provide this time. Thank you for your time.
Questions and discussions?
I always confused with the T1, T2 thing. What's the clinical significance of T1 image and T2 image?
What's the what?
Clinical significance. Clinical? So I don't do the MR sky, MRI scanning for, like, for example, IVD. Okay. Uh-huh. Some people see like T1 images, such as T2 images.
Uh-huh. Right. It's going to be different. it's the diseases will sometimes be darker on one image and brighter in another image.
Because I don't know anything about physics. What's the difference between T1 and T2? Because I don't understand your figure.
Right. Okay. Do you want the physical explanation of it? Yeah. I have some extra slides
right.
I can go through. Okay.
Yeah.
So T1. Okay. So T1, I think of this how fast it relaxes back to the liquid state. Okay. Since we're imaging stuff in the liquid state, liquids at room temperature, a lot of motion associated. Right? So all this motion by a bunch of electromagnets creates these alternating magnetic fields. You can reduce spin flips, all right? But from that classical physics type model, it's really how fast the spin is relaxing back along the magnetic field. Okay? And so this is going to be different in various tissues. And then we can get this kind of contrast just by adjusting our time in between our RF pulses, all right? So if you apply an RF pulse, say like a 90-degree pulse, right? Then it gets rid of any magnetism along that z direction. So from based on the time in between them, because some spins are relaxing faster than others, you get this difference in signal intensity from the faster relaxing spins and the slower relaxing spins. T2, we call spin-spin interactions. So the spins interact with each other. And what happens is that these spins start spinning at processing at slightly different frequencies. Okay, so even though we're looking at this aggregate, they're spinning at different frequencies. So what happens is that they start coherent, you know, aligned with each other. But over time, they start spreading out and dephasing. And from this dephasing, it results in a net loss of signal. So once it goes clean all the way around, then these spins really have lost all their signal, right? Now, it's not an even distribution, so it's not exactly like, I don't know what it would be, it's the sinusoidal kind of distribution, but when we measure it, it turns out to be just like an exponential decay. And we can adjust this weighting by what we call our echo time. So we apply RF pulse, and we can measure it immediately after, or even wait a little bit longer. Okay? If we acquire it immediately after, then there hasn't been much time for the spins to dephase. If we wait, you know, a little bit more, say about 100 milliseconds or so, then you know, they dephase a lot. In some tissues, they dephase faster than others. And that's how we get that kind of contrast.
Try with the 3 Tesla magnets.
Okay.
Do you try anything to do with the 3 Tesla magnets? Does your signal become bigger or
bigger?
Yeah, yeah. So. Because now you're doing only 1.
So going back to that initial equation, you see you get basically twice the signal on this. Okay. So, and that's a big deal because SNR really goes proportional to the square. So, in a sense, we get you can get the same signal in a quarter of the time of multiplicity. And the drawback of 3T, well, it's more expensive, but it also has more field inhomogeneities that we have to deal with. So, this is the field inhomogeneities scaled.
Yeah.
I know
there are 9 Tesla
models. 9 Tesla?
Yeah, there are.
Yes.
There are
a few. Chicago,
does,
right?
Yeah, you just see one.
Yep.
Does pulse sequence affect it?
Mm-hmm.
Does pulse sequence, different pulse sequences affect it, like spin echo pulse sequence?
Affect?
Delay position.
Yeah. What specifically do you want?
Maybe. Okay.
The position resolution.
Yeah.
The spin echo versus some other pulse sequence.
Yes, yeah, so spin echo is very common in that. Spin echo can help correct for some of these inhomogeneities. Because the inhomogeneities themselves also cause like this dephase. If you think of, you know, a voxel, and there's actually kind of like a gradient within that voxel, then that means some spins within that voxel are spinning faster than others by that magnetic field gradient. And this is separate from the T2 effect. Right? So. But with spin echo, we can kind of recover that. But the T2 effect, it's just inherent in those spins and we can't correct that. So spin echo, that's what spin echoes are used for. Now the gradient echo, because it suffers from that, sometimes there are interfaces or processes in the body which exhibit that same type of inhomogeneity created signal loss. And we can use this in our advantage to, for example, for blood flow. Right? So there's a lot more iron in it, then maybe it causes more these gradients to come in, then maybe you get a signal loss. Right? So that's the mechanism used for functional imaging in the brain. Right? So they have a patient lying scanning, they're constant scanning the brain constantly, right?
Yep.
And you see, you know, what areas in their brains are active, just by the blood flow.
Is there any such thing as blind spots? I think it's not the blind spots.
Blind spots?
No, your blind spots is fMRI, but not in MRI. Blind spots, no.
Blind
in
spots?
The brain, no.
I don't.
No.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think so.
I'm sorry.
I saw on your first page you actually had the list of the various things you're imaging in the oxygen 17. Does GE have a clinical interest in that yet, or
no.
Is it still in trial phases?
Yeah. As far as I know, we are not pursuing.
You're not pursuing. Any,
well, yeah, carbon 13 we are.
Oh, okay.
So carbon is an interesting situation in that it has to be. It has to be polarized and different. Okay? If you just put it in a magnet, we don't get enough MR signal. But you can use something called a hyperpolarizer. And I have to admit that I don't fully understand the physics behind it. But once you polarize that, okay, you have to image it pretty fast because it loses polarization like within a minute or so. So they have these setups. So you have a hyperpolarizer here, and have the carbon that's in the hyperpolarizer, so some sort of carbon molecule, typically pyruvate, okay, which is used by cancer a lot. You know, it's quick energy, and so you get that pyruvate sample, you polarize the carbon in it, and you have these tubes that feed, you know, like an IV into a patient, and you just shoot and get it optimized in a way so you get to the patient really really fast, and you image as fast as you can. So that seems to have some good. That is really the only other one that we're really pursuing. I think there's some interest in sodium, but GE is not involved in that.
Well, it's a broad field of research all over the world. Further questions, comments, discussions? Our students might find it exciting to chat with you afterwards. Okay. I know you got your PhD in biomedical engineering, but still you're in the physics group as a physicist, and you might be able to talk with you about physics majors and aspiring in this field. I know that we had one student, Adam, who graduated and was just a physics major, was so thrilled about biomedical that he went into KU Med School. So we have the people who just might want to, students who just might want to talk with you afterwards.
Even medical physics as a profession. There's a lot of physicists involved in that whole radiation therapy workflow. Physicists are involved in every step.
Let's thank our speaker again. You're welcome to come and discuss here or downstairs in the SPS room.